Hello and welcome to the CSDW's Writer's Talk. Today I'm lucky enough to have Tony Horwitz in the studio with me, who is the author of a new book called A Voyage Long and Strange. He also wrote Confederates in the Attic, and he's here to talk to us about participatory journalism and roasting yourself alive in a sweat lodge for a good book. So welcome, Mr. Horwitz.
Thanks for having me.
Great. You were a history major and a journalist for the Wall Street Journal and the New Yorker, things like that. How did you get into participatory journalism? What made you want to sacrifice your health and life for a good article?
I didn't do a lot of it as a journalist. It was more when I started writing books. But, you know, from time to time as a reporter, there are stories that are better told by doing it. So I did a story once about going undercover in a poultry processing plant to describe what it's like to slice and dice chicken all day. And I was in the Middle East and rode with the Camel Corps in Egypt to describe what that was like. So every once in a while, I found it helped me tell the story. It gives you a little humor, a little narrative. But in journalism, you know, there's a limit to how much I you can put in a story.
Mm-hmm. Although that seems to be, do you think that's changing a little bit? Does it seem to be more personal in journalism now?
I think now with blogging and all the online venues, sure, it's all the rules are changing. But I was sort of, you know, one of the dinosaurs, last of the old print journalist types, where, you know, at the Wall Street Journal and elsewhere, unless there was a reason for you to be in the story, you weren't supposed to be.
Right. Okay. Meryl Marco said to me that even when she experiences terrible events, she's a comedy writer, she's always thinking that the experiences will make great comedy later. In A Voyage Long and Strange, you describe a very difficult sweat lodge ceremony that is a pretty humorous fashion in your book. I love the line the next day when you're going downstairs after having survived all of this very hot, very smoky environment, and somebody says, "Oh yeah, I saw a guy go into a sweat lodge on crutches once and come running back out." That's one of my favorite lines in the book. During the roasting, were you thinking about what great material this was going to be later, or was it just, how do I get out of here, and how long do I have to really suffer through it?
Yeah, I think it's the sickness of writing that, you know, however horrible the experience is, some little voice inside is going, yeah, but this is going to be a great story. So I think that probably helped me get through what was quite an ordeal. I thought I was in for sort of a locker room sauna when I was invited into this traditional sweat lodge, and yeah, crawled out on my hands and knees 4 hours later, yeah, basically feeling as if I'd been cooked alive. But, you know, I think particularly with sort of travel writing, the worst parts of your journey are always the best.
Mm-hmm. Those are the good parts nobody really wants to hear about. You know, when you have a good meal, nobody cares. But if you find something dead in your meal that wasn't supposed to be dead in your meal,
That's a good story. Yeah, unless you're writing for a travel magazine where they want to hear about, you know, the wonderful food and drink in France or something. But I've never done that kind of writing.
When you have a story like this one, have you, in the sweat lodge, do you hear back from any of the people? Have you had any sort of blowback where they said, no, you're exaggerating, it's really much more pleasant in the sweat lodge, or they don't read this stuff afterwards?
Mm-hmm. What have you had people?
I didn't get feedback from those folks specifically, but I try and send my book to as many of the people that I can track down who were in it. And, you know, I think as long as you get your facts right and you portray a scene accurately, people will cut you a little slack in terms of your own spin on it. So, you know, generally speaking, I get a positive response. Yeah, every once in a while somebody takes you to task, but it's never for what you think they'll not like. That's what I've learned over the years. It's always something you didn't even think about that for some reason rubs them the wrong way, and the thing that you thought was going to offend them doesn't. So it's it's hard to overthink. You have to just write what you write.
Has that been... I'm wondering whether you bring a lot of humor to your writing, I think, intentionally. And I'm curious whether the humor is the thing that most often causes problems, or is it just is it something else about the telling of the story?
Yeah, I wouldn't say it's the humor. And I think the humor helps because I make a lot of fun of myself. So, I sometimes make fun of other people, but I'm kind of equal opportunity there. Everybody is... gets a little bit of a, you know, gentle ribbing. No, it's not the humor that gets them. It's maybe a little bit. I did a book about Confederate reenactors, or it was largely about that. And they don't have a huge sense of humor about what they do. So perhaps they didn't like that I kind of made a joke out of the whole thing. So you just never know. Some stray detail about what someone was wearing and that rubs them the wrong way. But generally speaking, I've had very little of that. Most people seem happy in the end.
You know, as I read through the book, A Journey Long and Strange, which I really recommend, the thing that kept striking me was, it reminded me of a comment a friend of mine who was an MFA, who was a creative writer, said that fiction was all about people doing horrible things to each other. And this book reads like people doing unbelievably horrible things to each other. And I admired that you were trying to be in the middle of it, and you didn't go one way or the other, because it seemed pretty clear at times that, you know, the European influence was, as the Indian Native Americans have often said, just ghastly for their culture, and the worst possible thing. And did you have a lot of times when that was a struggle to see from that viewpoint, to remain journalistically neutral?
Right. I think we've kind of swung from one extreme to the other in the way we look at these early explorers. In the old days, they were viewed as sort of heroes and, you know, bringing Christianity and civilization to the natives. And then we swung to sort of the opposite extreme, where they're all complete monsters and the advanced men of empire and didn't discover anything. They just destroyed it. And obviously, it's tremendous damage done, and I don't, paper over any of that in the book. On the other hand, I still think we can, whether or not we approve of what these early explorers did, they were important. One can be interested in a Hernando de Soto, who was an absolute butcher, was an important figure and also a fascinating one. So I don't think it's necessary to constantly pass judgment on writing about history. And also I like to leave it to the reader to kind of form their own judgments rather than hitting them over the head.
Okay. And I think you stayed at the DeSoto Motor Lodge and the William Bradford Motor Lodges as well. So you're supporting their descendants, apparently, by the Pocahontas ice cream shop or the sweet shop, that all of the commercialization of history that was that you talk about in the book, which is really interesting. When you're going through and you're reading all this stuff, you've got, I think, a bibliography of 202 sources that you consulted, something amazing. I didn't count. I read somewhere else. But I was fascinated by all the sources. Where did you track all these down? How many places did you have to go to find this? Because I had this picture later on of you alternately, you know, being swarmed by the largest mosquitoes ever as you stopped on the side of the road, and we'll leave the rest of that story for the people to read. But there's that, and then there's you going over what I was thinking of, like parchments, with wearing gloves in a climate-controlled environment. How did all that work out?
It was about half and half traditional historical research, and then, me on the road, on the trail of the figures I'm writing about. Most of this history is hiding in plain sight, which is part of why it's strange we've chosen to forget it. I didn't have that hard a time. I had used mostly archives at Harvard University and elsewhere when I was on the road. A lot of the history, was in particular libraries or historical sites. For me, that's a lot of fun. But really, it wasn't as hard as you might think to get a hold of the material. The problem is a lot of it is in 16th century Castilian or very antiquated French, or in the case of the Vikings, obviously the Norse sagas. So I either was reading things in translation or had to get people to help me to read them.
One of the things that I should have said earlier is that this book goes from the very beginning of discovery, all the pre-Mayflower stuff, the history that we don't get in schools and never seems to be taught. And I'm curious about your your opinion, why not teach history through sort of books like this? I remember the history books when I was a kid 2-3 years ago, you know, in high school, at college. And I remember that they were A, rather boring, B, and I'll get in trouble for this, always taught by the football coach, and C, we always started with the Mayflower, and then we almost got to World War II. That was my experience, like over and over and over. That was history. That was American history. What do you think if somebody were to pick up your text and say, we're going to teach this quarter and this is going to be history?
Mm-hmm. Well, I mean, you know, I wish we did, not necessarily my book, but teach, you know, what's in it, these events, because, you know, nothing dismays me more than when people say, you know, I hate history, it's homework. And I think we can be a little too pious about our history, partly because we always begin it with those dreary pilgrims. And in fact, you know, if kids could be turned on to conquistadors and marauding Vikings and Pocahontas and all these great, the true Pocahontas, all these wonderful stories that precede the Mayflower story, I think kids might be more excited about history right from the go. Mm-hmm.
You know, I'm curious about that, the true Pocahontas. Now that you've written this book, what do you think the odds are of finding truth in history or finding and moving through the myths that we're so ready to believe? Mm-hmm. What is your take on that?
Well, first of all, you know, I think we have to be humble about how close we can get to the truth about any of these stories, you know, hundreds of years ago, where the sources can be quite sketchy or unreliable. So, you know, you do the best you can. No, I think we're very invested in these myths. You know, we need a creation story, a story of origins. And for instance, the Plymouth story gives us a kind of specific point of origin, Plymouth. It gives us a sacred rock, gives us a sacred ceremony with Thanksgiving. It's kind of a nice package there. So to tell people, well, you know, that's not really the story. It's much messier. There are many more characters, and it's not a very pretty story a lot of the time. Well, it's hard to make a sort of national story of origin out of that. So I'm not confident that we're going to sort of toss over the pilgrims in favor of, you know, the Spanish and the French and all the others who were wandering around here long before the pilgrims got here.
Now, you've got a great cover illustration, cartoons showing different places on your journey where you had stopped. It was that, I'm curious about that. Oftentimes, writers don't have a lot of control over their cover illustrations, but I thought that this one was particularly striking because it seemed to me to be an attempt to, A, convey the tone of the book, mm-hmm. the sometimes humorous, but also I was wondering if it was a way to appeal to maybe a slightly younger demographic with this book. What was the take on that?
You know, I wish I could take some credit for that. You know, you have some input. That was really the publisher's decision. The hardback had a picture from the archives that I had found that they sort of adapted in bright colors, again, to convey that this is history, but history with a twist. And I guess they just went a little further with this, the paperback cover, with, as you say, these kind of cartoonish figures. Mm-hmm. I think it's more some marketing decision on there, you know, position it more as travel and less as history. But I can't say I had a lot of input in that.
Now, a person who was reading the book, works with me, wanted me to ask you this question. In your author photo, there's a very good-looking dog, but the dog makes no appearance in the thing. And it prompted us to ask, you know, how many weeks on the road does it take to produce a travelogue like this, where you're traveling alone without even the company of the handsome dog? How long did it take?
It's a little hard to time exactly because the book overall was about 4 years, and I would tend to do some research, hit the road, come back, do more research. So all told, there was probably a year of traveling spread over a couple of years of time. So if I had to guess, I'd say about a year on the road.
And you've got a knack, it seems, for walking into places and finding people to talk to you. Is this something that's always been part of your character? Is this a journalistic trait that you've picked up? How do you walk into a bar like the one you describe that's surprisingly full of a bunch of Norse sort of people in the middle of, I think it's
Kansas?
Yeah, Kansas. And what's the trick there?
The trick is you walk in, order a drink, and start talking to people. I think that does reflect having spent 15 years as a journalist, a lot of it overseas, helpless and lost. And I think you just get over any shame about just going up to strangers and saying, help me, you know, lost tourist here, talk to me, or just chatting. And what's the worst that can happen? You know, they walk away, they slam a door in your face, and that rarely happens, particularly in America. People love to talk. So I've just found over the years, you know, it's easier than it looks.
Mm-hmm. Well, I was thinking about that. You describe a journey that you take with someone you meet in, I think it's Colombia?
Dominican Republic.
And the journey seems terrifying to me. You're relying on someone you've never met to go into what seems like sort of a dangerous area in a place where you don't speak the language. My hat is off to you. I could never do this, but I was fascinated by the ability to do it.
Uh-huh. Again, I think it's just become second nature for me. I don't think it was that dangerous. He was a terrible driver. Probably the most dangerous thing I did on that trip was eat chicharrones, which is a sort of Dominican delicacy that's sort of pig skin with fat and gristle hanging off, sort of fried with car fumes, etc. Dominicans love it, and it's famously fatal to foreigners.
Right. I remember him saying, you've got 4 hours to live.
When he found out I'd eaten it, he said, yeah, you know, whatever. We better move quickly because you only have a few hours left to live. I survived.
I was going to say, you don't mention anything from that point on. There's no discussion of any repercussions.
Well, there were some, but I'm not sure the reader needs to know all the details of one's travels.
Right. Okay. Well, it also made me wonder, was it the only thing to eat in that area? You just made that decision that you were going to take that risk?
Yeah, as I describe in the book, we hadn't eaten all day, and there was no electricity in this town. It was at night, and it was just a guy on the street sort of carving some meat that I couldn't identify. It looked kind of like burnt ear. And I thought, well, I'll give it a try. Mm. And it tasted good in a kind of disgusting sort of way, maybe a little like crackling or something. And so I had several portions of it. And not until the next day did I find out, you know, that I had taken my life in my hands.
Right, yeah. Well, I think any time you have the opportunity to eat burnt ear, should take it.
Should never be missed. I also had cod tongues in Newfoundland. Who knew cod had tongues?
I remember thinking that same thing. I didn't know that. It never occurred to me that fish had tongues.
Yeah.
Are they the only fish that has a tongue?
I really couldn't tell you that, but I can tell you that when it comes on your plate, it's sort of fried in a sort of dough that you could be eating anything. So that was, it was like fried clams. You know.
Okay. Now, with all the sources that you went, you've said that they're sort of, they can be unreliable or ambiguous. How do you gauge the accuracy of a source? Are you always trying to find... often journalists will always try to have two sources for the same sort of fact, or three. How do you do this with something like the Norse sagas, or do you just make a decision that I'm going to take what they say with a slight grain of salt and just relay it and see what happens?
Right. In an instance like the Norse sagas, that's really the only written source we have from that era. However, there's, for instance, archaeological evidence that confirms part of the sagas. They say they went to here, and, well, what do you know? Archaeologists found the remains of a Norse settlement. So I think you do, in a sense, what you do as a journalist, you try and get the most reliable information you can, and you try and be open with the reader about what we really can know and what is kind of hazy. And I think you, over time, reading a lot of these accounts from this era, you begin to be able to tell who are reliable narrators and who's just making stuff up out of whole cloth.
You know, it's funny because the conquistadors' records struck me particularly as people who weren't aware of PR. Because they record many of the horrible things that they did.
Exactly. I mean, for instance, court documents, I think, are, any historian would say, are one of the, you know, treasures, because they tend to be, people are under oath, or it's a fact-finding commission. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you're getting at the absolute truth. And yes, the Spanish are constantly prosecuting themselves. You know, these conquistadors come back, and you get in great detail the atrocities committed against native people.
Mm-hmm. I'm interested in that you make a couple of guesses about why we're so willing to believe these myths. We need the myth of the beginning of the U.S. We need an origin myth. We need a way to have something wonderful to latch onto. Oh, the
pilgrims were hardworking. They were also incredibly disorganized. And I'm curious why you think it is that we are so poorly educated about our history, and we're so willing to just take the myths when we've now sort of discovered it. Is it, it just all comes back to the same thing for you then?
No, I mean, I think there are a couple things at work. One is that this history was largely written by Protestant New Englanders soon after this nation was created, and so they sort of exalted their own and diminished the contributions of any Catholics and Spanish and French. They also diminished Southerners. After all, Jamestown precedes Plymouth by 13 years as the first permanent colony, English colony on this continent, yet somehow Plymouth still is number one. That was partly about the Civil War and sort of Northerners not being very fond of the South. So there are a number of factors, but I think it's mainly just at some point we have so much invested in these stories. Here in Columbus, you have your Santa Maria on the river, even though Columbus never came to North America. We all celebrate Thanksgiving, even though the Pilgrims don't really mention it in their journals. They have, you know, one line, and it's not a Thanksgiving. There's no mention of a rock at all at Plymouth. So, you know, we have these stories, and we create holidays around them and pageantry, and, you know, it's hard to toss that out.
I want to be clear, though, that the Santa Maria was sent here right after, you know, he really came. That's the...
He came right up the river.
Yeah, it was right up the Scioto to the Olentangy, and it was no problem. He was looking for the Northwest Passage. That's the myth that we... I mean, the history that we tell in Columbus, and that's why we're named after him. Do you see the same thing with your children's education now? Do you see... I'm just curious, after you've done all this writing, you come home, and... you have, I think, one child.
Yeah, two sons in elementary school. So I do see this. I would say, at least since my own childhood, you know, back in the dark ages, there's much more sensitivity to the native story and the African American story. So, for instance, Jamestown will be taught as the meeting of three cultures. So I would say, in that sense, it's improved. But in terms of including the complexity in all these other stories, the Spanish and the French and others, I don't think it's changed much. There's some regional differences. If you grow up in the Southwest, you're going to get a little more of that. But generally speaking, no. I think we still cling to the same old set of quote-unquote facts.
Mm-hmm. I suppose part of that is watering it down for kids who probably wouldn't understand, who might not necessarily grasp all the implications of the things that occurred or wouldn't want to face.
I don't know that that's it. One, you know, with two boys, I know they love gore. I mean, I think they would be, and little girls too, I think they would be much more excited about the story if you told them all about the cannibalism and the murder and the mayhem. But I think it's also, you know, we're getting even more and more test-based, less time for teachers to stray off the kind of conventional narrative. So it's not just this era that's forgotten. Between the Mayflower and the Revolution, how many Americans know much about the colonial period? Again, we just sort of skip over it. We tick off, you know, a few points in our history, and that's it.
So hopefully someday soon there'll be a question on exams. How many people were eaten? How many early explorers were eaten by cannibals before?
I should point out that the only hard evidence we have of cannibalism in this period is Europeans eating each other. There's actually no accounts of, or no reliable accounts of Indians eating natives. Indians eating Europeans.
Even though that was the basis, I think, for... you know, Caliban in Shakespeare and things like that. It's sad, really.
In fact, the word cannibal comes from Columbus's first voyage. He hears that from the natives. They're trying to scare them away and talk about these man-eaters, and he hears the word as cannibal, and that's where we get it.
And one of the other themes I noticed in the book that I thought was really interesting is that people, you know, you get this view of these uneducated the natives and they're always portrayed as sort of childlike and things, but they were really clever often about sending them, oh no, there's gold over there. If you go over to that place where it's usually their enemies, they have lots of gold. Yeah. And so the conquistadors pick up and they go over and kill a bunch of other people somewhere else.
Right. The Indians are not only obviously very clever,
They tend to be bigger than Europeans. The Europeans are kind of dressed all wrong for the climate. They can't feed themselves. Mm-hmm. They have no women and children with them generally. These Indians, you get a sense, often look at these newcomers as rather pathetic, which may be one reason they underestimated how much damage they could do.
Well, one of the things I'd like to do now is I'd like to launch into like a short answer kind of things that gets your... it's stolen from In the Actor's Studio. What's the best part about being a writer?
Best part, I would say freedom. And that's not true for all writers, but I'm lucky enough now to work full-time as a book author. And, you know, day-to-day, I'm my own boss. And you know, every few years, yes, I have to deliver a manuscript, and I work with an editor. But I think I have much more control over my work life than most people.
Okay. What's the worst part?
The same thing, in a way. There's no one there on a daily basis to kind of lean over you and make you work. It's all got to come from you. And, you know, staring at a blank computer screen day after day can get to you. So I would say the lack of structure, in a way, can also be very hard.
What's the best writing job you've had?
I think the best writing job I've had is the one I have now. I loved doing journalism, but... I think it's a young person's game. You need an extraordinary amount of energy. It's totally incompatible with family life. So I don't miss it. I like what I do now.
What's the worst writing job you've had?
Well, you know, again, the horrible jobs are kind of fun to talk about in retrospect. I think for almost every journalist, your first job. Where I remember I worked at a small paper in Indiana, my first newspaper job, and the first day I was there, I had to go knock on the door of the mother of someone who had just been picked up for axe murder and essentially say, how do you feel about your son being an axe murderer? You know, that kind of, you know, trenches journalism, you know, was not always fun.
I love the picked up for axe murder. Like,
yeah.
There's a separate category for there's murder and then there's axe murder.
Yeah.
You've been charged with axe murder. What would you do if you weren't a writer? What other profession?
I would be in trouble if I weren't a writer. I have no other skills, and I'm not sure I have that skill. Perhaps teaching. Originally, I wanted to be a historian, be a professor at some beautiful campus like this. It's a little hard to do that without an advanced degree, but maybe someplace would take me.
What genre haven't you written that you'd like to try? What's do you have a romance novel?
I've never written fiction, at least not intentionally, and actually don't have a lot of desire. I love reading it, but I don't feel compelled to write it, which is just as well. There are enough novelists out there. I want to write a straight history without any antics. So that's something I've never done that I would like to do.
Do you get a lot of feedback from historians about the kind of writing you do, whether they positive or negative? Do they communicate with you?
Yeah, and I always try and work pretty closely with some historians to make sure I've got my facts right and bounce my interpretation off them. So yeah, the feedback I would say is really 99% positive, and I think most professional historians want to reach a wider audience, and so they're happy to see general readers learning about a period that doesn't usually get a lot of attention.
Who's your biggest influence as a writer?
I would say maybe Studs Terkel. When I was young, before I got into writing, I remember reading some of his books where he just did very straight interviews with people, although there was a lot more art to it than maybe there appears to be. And I think perhaps just listening to people tell their stories and realizing that everybody has a good story to tell.
What's your secret vice of an author or a genre?
I am mortified to say I have a fantasy baseball team. And every day I probably devote 15 or 20 minutes when I could be reading The New Yorker or some great novel to reading analysis of yesterday's ball games. And I have to say the writing doesn't tend to be that strong.
Is your team doing well? Your fantasy?
Second place. So,
oh.
You asked, you know, if I crap out as a writer, maybe I could start writing a fantasy baseball column.
All right. Well, I thank you very much
for
talking to us today, and you have a great day.
Thank you.
You too.